So this is on that hugely popular socialist subject of love and relationships. I'm being a bit sarcastic here because I've definitely seen some members gaze at the ceiling with a kind of long-suffering look when the subject of human relationships comes up. We did once have a Vercroft summer school on this, and I think some members actually stayed away on purpose. There is a kind of feeling amongst some members, I think, that personal stuff like this is kind of outside the domain of party politics, and it's not really the job of socialists to talk about this kind of thing. You can sort of debate that point in a minute if you like. But it's definitely true that we never cover the subject in the Standard. Our writers don't write about it. We just don't get articles about that sort of thing. But we've also got no literature on it, not really, not even a leaflet, much less a pamphlet. But I do dimly recall, somebody might be able to help me out here, I think back in the 1970s the party did a special issue of the Socialist Standard on sex and relationships. And it was one of only two issues that I've ever heard of that sold out. There seemed to be a kind of lesson there that we didn't learn. It's not as though it's a sort of esoteric subject either, like, I don't know, Asian rice-growing economies or medieval astrology. It's something that's absolutely central to everyone's life. It's, you know, so central that lots of people can't stop going on about it. The rest of the world can't shut up about it, and popular culture is completely drenched in it. And it's also not as though we can pretend that there's nothing political about human relationships. When, you know, we know that human relationships are very political. If you think, you only have to think about the concept of marriage and the, you know, property owning values that are built into that concept. Think about the subjection of women in marriage and about childcare and domestic violence. Then there are the nebulous and shifting ideas around what is acceptable and what is deviant sexual behaviour. Take homophobia as one recently quite rapidly changing social attitude, but it remains a toxic legacy of colonial rule in former British colonies, because of course the British exported homophobia to its colonies, and now we flatter ourselves in mainland Britain that we're all enlightened and we're enlightened and liberal society, but of course we gave those former colonies homophobic attitudes that they didn't, in many cases, didn't previously have, and are now quite rampant. And of course, there are current struggles with prejudice that transsexual people are having to deal with. And it's also, there's no reason that I can think of why we don't talk about relationships. I was told once, and again, somebody might be able to correct me on this, that back in the 1930s, along with lots of other left radicals, party members had a craze for two things. One was being members of things like the Clarion Cycling Club, and the other one was free love. I don't know if they were following the ideas of Wilhelm Reich or what it was, but it was certainly apparently a thing at the time. Where did all that go? Did it all just become a bit quaint and dated, you know, like flower power? Or is it the case that the party nowadays is so dominated by us blokes that we'd really rather talk about something abstract and impersonal that doesn't make us feel so awkward? And ultimately, what do we have to say about future socialist society and relationships? Some members, I know for a fact, some members think that marriage and monogamy, you know, being constructs of property society, well, we'll go out of the window in socialist society. But what kind of relationships would replace that? And even if we had ideas about how to answer that question, would we actually want to come out and say it? Because here I get to the nub of the matter, which is, do we avoid certain subjects because we don't want to scare away the working class? Or is it the case that we are in fact scaring away the working class because we avoid certain subjects? Okay, with that, I leave it open to you.
I'd like to say, Paddy, on your last remark there, we avoid, well, my experience anyway, that we avoid certain subjects when we know very little about them. And this particular part, you know, this love relationship, you know very little about it.
But is that, surely that's not true. I mean, all of us have relationships. Maybe they're not always personal, you know, marital relationships, but surely we all have relationships with people around us at work, social friendships. It can't be the case that we know nothing about this, as if we know more about Marxist economics than we know about loving relationships. I find that really hard to believe, and it says something very strange about the Socialist Party, if what you're saying, Brian, is actually true of most party members.
I should have clarified myself there, Paddy, I'm sorry. No, the party has always been about social relationships. Love, right, doesn't come into a social relationship. It only comes into an individual relationship between one, two or three people at most.
Well, again, I don't understand this this binary dichotomy that you're creating between an individual relationship and a social relationship, as if they inhabit different spheres. Surely they're part of the same thing. They're part of the same cultural construct that we live in, aren't they?
Not according to the materialist conception of history. The social relationship that Marxists and socialists concerned about is social relationship between unequals and equals. And love doesn't come into that. So
we don't talk about love because Marx didn't write about it in his economic manuscripts. Is that what you're saying?
For God's sake. That's ridiculous. You know, we don't need Marx to tell us about relationships. We have them every day. We've had them. And I think people are not terribly open about relationships, perhaps because they don't want to upset or hurt the partner, as in their ideas, their real ideas or their real thoughts might not be compatible to their partner's. For instance, if you believe, I mean, for instance, I don't believe that monogamy is natural. If it was natural, then it would seem, why is it so difficult, or it seems so difficult for people, men and women, to remain faithful? Even if they are faithful, it's often difficult, and they don't do it, or they don't think about doing it because they know they might hurt their partner. Our relationships, I think, in this society, are so complicated. We get with people for various reasons, and women are brought up. A lot of girls are brought up still today with the idea of the big day is the wedding. That's the big day. They can dress up. They're going to marry their one and only. They're the one for them. You know, it's almost as if there's only one person for you in this life, and you've met the one. So girls dream of getting married, and the big day, the dress, and then obviously the reality sets in, and the babies, and the bills, and the boredom, perhaps, because who says that relationships have got to last 30, 40, 50 years. If they do, that's bloody brilliant, you know. If they truly are happy together, that's brilliant. But often their relationships have a time span. And I think that, as I say, our relationships are commercialized. Some women, I can only speak for women really, to be quite honest. Women often get married for security, and perhaps men do too. Men get married for comfort. They go from their mum looking after them to a woman looking after them, even in this day and age, You know, we talk about the modern man and the modern woman. But it's, I don't think that much has changed. And, you know, we need, it's almost like you need two people, two parents working to look after children. Whereas in a socialist society, you know, a woman, if she wanted a child and hasn't found a partner wanting to have a child with her, or, you know, she can do that. She can do that because she knows that, that she'll be supported by society. So a lot of relationships we're forced, not forced into, but we're encouraged into, or we go into for various different reasons. None of those reasons, apart from love and apart from wanting to, none of those reasons would be relevant in a socialist society. What do other people think?
Yeah, I completely agree, Carla. I think you've hit the nail right on the head there. That's certainly how I see things. Yeah, and, you know, relationships in a socialist society, they'd have a, you know, that sort of freedom. And of course, they, well, by freedom, I mean, you know, they don't have the constraints of the economics, which, you know, heavily influence relationships in capitalism. You know, as you've alluded to, you know, it's all about, you know, sort of paying bills, or, you know, negotiating what financial advantages or disadvantages there might be to living in a, as a couple. And, you know, how many arguments would be caused by, you know, financial issues. And, you know, of course, that can sort of, along with other reasons, you know, sort of step over into domestic violence under capitalism. But, yeah, socialist relationships wouldn't have those economic chains around them. And of course, with that would go a lot of prejudice and prejudice, which is, you know, sort of has material explanations in capitalism. So obviously those material circumstances which lead to prejudice or stereotypes, you know, won't apply, you know, that have had the rug pulled under them. I think freedom's all about freedom would be what socialist relationships would be about. And yeah, of course, you know, there's plenty for us to write about, you know, either from a perspective within capitalism or speculating a bit under socialism. And although I certainly don't agree with seeing a necessity to tie the issue to Marx, you know, it is found there in Marx under his the economic and philosophical manuscripts have been mentioned. But yeah, you know, alienation, I don't think that word's come up this evening so far. You know, alienation in different forms, and alienation from other people is one of those. So yeah, it's there in Marx, not very well developed by him himself. You know, you'd have to go to the other Marxists who've interpreted his stuff on alienation to get a deeper look into that. But yeah, yeah. So yeah, I agree, Carla. Yeah, thanks for that contribution.
Jealousy, natural conditioning. How about that one?
There was probably some evolutionary advantage to it at some point, and that's maybe part of the reason it's still there. But yeah, I think it would be, you know, that's a material thing often, jealousy, isn't it? Or, you know, the result of feeling trapped, you know, trapped in a relationship. You know, there'd be less jealousy around if there was more freedom.
I was just looking at patterns of monogamy and polygamy amongst other animal species, because I remember that meerkats pair bond, and also swans. But swans, it turns out, have affairs. And it appears that 90% of bird species are monogamous, but most of them cheat. In other words, in the sense that they have what's called social but not genetic monogamy. So they hang around in pairs, but they go off and play when they feel like it, it seems. I don't know, the point of this being that you can't look to the animal, any animal species, and say, there we are, there's a natural way to behave. There clearly isn't. What Mike said about, could there be an evolutionary, you know, purpose behind jealousy? I mean, we know that some mammals, when they take over sort of troop, like chimpanzees, they tend to kill the children of the previous troop leader to preserve their own genes. There could be something like that, but again, it's difficult to conclude anything from how animals behave. So I think we could say that any kind of behaviour would be open to us, and that monogamy, I don't think any of us really doubt it, do we? It's a construct of property society.
I would disagree with that. Most immediate return hunter-gatherers, in fact, all immediate return hunter-gatherers that I know, have serial monogamy as their normative way of being, and that that's not to say that playing the field doesn't actually occur, but it's generally frowned on. In delayed return hunter-gatherers, it's occasional that a woman will take more than one lover at a time, but it's not very common. And jealousy in those societies is rife, really. It's by far the largest cause of a conflict among individuals, among young men in particular.
That's interesting. So do you have any kind of explanation for why that might be? Or are we just going to say this is natural human behaviour?
I wouldn't like to say that definitively. I can only comment on, I don't know that anyone has ever come up with a particular reason for that. Among hunter-gatherers in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, there's about a million of them, or anything up to a million of them. The women in diverse communities that haven't been in touch for thousands of years, they have a very similar saying, and that is one woman, one penis.
Monogamy isn't monogamy, is it? Because monogamy is staying with one person for the rest of your life. If you're saying serial monogamy, it means, yeah, you only have one man at a time or one woman at a time. But that doesn't, you know, that could be 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. That's hardly monogamy the way Western society sees it, surely.
Well, that all depends how you define monogamy. Monogamy just really means one man, one woman. It doesn't actually specify a time period when that actually occurs. So, in hunter-gatherer societies, monogamy is serial. One man, one woman at a time. And as you say, there's no marriage in these societies, so two people get together because they want to, and if one of them gets fed up with it, they just walk out, and that's the end of it. It's as simple as that. But, yeah, it's the one man, one woman idea, which anthropologists refer to as monogamy, that is the basis. It doesn't necessarily have to go on forever.
Very few of us here this evening, but it seems that not many of us want to talk about this subject, really.
Like I mentioned, we have very little experience of it. In a social context, that is.
Well, I don't know where to start, but I certainly go along with pretty much all that Carla said. There's also this aspect of, you know, around the world, religions. Some religions say you can have more than one. That is, the man can have more than one. Other religions, like, let's take the Western religion of Protestantism, Catholicism, people, it's like you get married and you're not supposed to get out of it. Whether you still like the relationship or not, there's something in that says, no, it's a lifelong commitment, and you make that commitment, don't you, when you get married, which seems a totally crazy thing as far as I'm concerned. I just can't imagine how people can look that far ahead. But the biggest thing, of course, about it all is the capitalist thing. You were talking, Carla touched on it, Mike touched on it, the thing about everything is linked to money, one way or the other. And it just so happens that because of the inequality in work relations or whatever, that wherever you are, mostly it impacts more on the woman than on the man, that she can't get away from a relationship, even if she wants to. But as far as like what Brian's saying about like we don't talk about it, because I didn't really quite understand why he thought we didn't talk about it. I'm not talking about Marx either. I don't hear that bit again. But the fact that as if we're not comfortable with talking about it. I'm very comfortable about talking about it. It doesn't bother me at all. What about other people? I mean, why should we be uncomfortable talking about it? An awful lot of us will have a partner, married or not, and some of us will have left that relationship. Some of us won't have left that relationship. We're surely a mixed bag between us anyway. And why not talk about it? I think as far as socialism is concerned, heavens above, if we ever get there, well, we're all still people, and we all still have got all the different baggage of lives that we would need to sort out one way or the other. All right, we get there gradually, we hope. But I don't see why anything at all should be that we shouldn't be able to talk about. I think it should all be open.
I think the party has sort of discussed it a few times. You know, Paddy mentioned the summer school, which was the 2013 one, I think it was, the relationships one. Heather Ball's articles and the compilation of them, a socialist life. That's always been a very popular booklet, precisely because it focuses on a more personal look at capitalism, and relationships are mentioned quite often in her articles. And I'm sure we've had the occasional socialist standard article about it. So I don't think we ignore the issue, but we certainly need to raise it much more. Something Janet said about marriage and that sort of threw a thought into my head, that why should a relationship, whether or not, of course with marriage, it's a very much long-term commitment is the on the surface of it, the aim of it, if you like, if that's one way of putting it. But why should a relationship need to be sanctioned by the state or worse, by a church? If a relationship is meaningful, then, both parties should recognise that for themselves. It doesn't need to be rubber stamped by a state. That seems quite demeaning to relationships. I know plenty of other people wouldn't see it that way, but why does a relationship need that kind of official sanction? Same with civil partnerships. They're seen as hip and trendy, but it's the same thing. That's one thing I can't quite get about capitalism, about having a relationship affirmed in that way.
Because under capitalism, it's a private property relationship.
The thing is that my sister is a solicitor, and she's very much, not that I don't know what her real personal ideas are about marriage, but the point is that if you are not married in this society, you lose rights. For instance, property rights. It's all about money and property. But if you're not married, it's much more difficult for a father to have access to any children of that marriage. It's harder for a woman to ask for any kind of maintenance, depending on who left to and for what reasons. But I've got a couple of friends who have only recently got married after many, many, many years, for a tax thing, because it's they get tax less. So, there are reasons why people get married, and they're not always for romantic reasons.
Yeah, well, I can cite opposing examples of people who don't get married because the married rate of, well, what's now universal credit, you know, basic income support and things like that, is about 1.5 times the single rate. So they don't get, they don't want to get married or be caught cohabiting because they get more money that way. So, you know, the property society actually stopped some people getting married. But I've also asked, I've always been a bit baffled, same as Mike actually, about this. You know, why do people feel the need to get permission? I just, I've asked people who've, you know, some couples have been married for years and they say, oh, well, it's not really about having permission. It's more about making a sort of public declaration that you're then obliged to stick to. And I remember asking some friends, a friend sort of quite recently, that, you know, did he think that having made this kind of public, you know, declaration in this way, did he think that, that this had been good for his relationship? And he went, oh, definitely. He said we would have split up 10 times over if it hadn't been for that. So I thought that was quite funny.
I think men are less keen to actually get married. I think women see it as a commitment, and I think they think it's probably not quite so easy to walk away from than if they were just living together. But of course, these days, when women work and you have a house together and you're both working, I think it's, there's probably not an awful lot of difference as far as the law is concerned. But but Paddy, you're talking about people who are on benefits. Well, the majority of us couples, I don't think, are on benefits, and therefore, you know, yes, of course, that would affect people who are on benefits. But I think most of us who are not see it as paying less tax.
The benefits thing, yeah, I've seen that as an issue among couples quite often. Yeah, it's a thing. Yeah, obviously within a certain demographic, but yeah, that happens quite often.
I think the bottom line really is that whichever way you look at it, and whatever under whatever circumstances that you view it, I mean, it's property ultimately that is probably the most important factor in the whole sort of marriage thing. And there's an anthropological view on this, and that patriarchy in itself, you know, which establishes marriage, is seen as property driven. That in fact, there's a very strong theory in anthropology that the very first property were women, fundamentally. And that's been modeled in a number of ways, on the basis of, ethnographies of studies of various groups in the process of changing from hunter-gatherer type status to farming, or initially to horticulture or to pastoralism, because in those movements, what is actually happening is that property is starting to exist as soon as you stop hunting game and you actually have to put labor into the ground for so many months of the year in order to get a return from it, you've got a start of property. And although that took thousands of years to develop, it's really quite clear from the evidence that we actually have is that with property comes marriage and comes patriarchy. The three things are absolutely tied together. Property and the marriage system, the marriage process are just like two sides of the same coin. In hunter-gatherer societies, you know, it's like it's generally women live with women. They are matrilocal. A woman lives with her mother in the course of a relationship. She does not go to live with her husband or with her husband's family. She lives with her mother, and the man comes to her. And the relationship will continue for as long as he provides bride service, which is as he continues to provide support, food, meat to the woman's family. But as soon as you actually start to move into sort of property society, into horticulture, agriculture, pastoralism, where you actually have like something which is a store of value. If you take pastoralism, you know, where you have cattle are become a store of value, then instead of bringing meat from the hunt every day to a woman's family, the man's family can offer cattle, which can then reproduce and survive and continue to feed the woman's family over a long, long period of time. But as soon as you do that, the woman is trapped, because this has been given as a long-term loan to the woman's family. And she then is encouraged to come and live with the husband's family so she can work on his farm. And if the woman gets fed up with the relationship, whereas before she would have been able to just walk out, she can't walk out now, because her family have actually received cattle from her husband's family. And so she becomes their property. So in this sense, you know, tracing it right back, marriage becomes a property relationship. And with it becomes patriarchy. Women go to live with their husbands rather than husbands going to their wives and their wives' families.
Well, that makes sense, Richard. I mean, I wonder if I misunderstood something that you said earlier, though, because I understood you to say initially that that arguably women were the first type of property, but that would kind of suggest that the ownership or the subjection of women predated property society, which would kind of be turning some of our ideas on their head. Did I misunderstand what you were saying there?
No, that is it's an issue of interpretation, really, which comes first. But it's what is seen as happening is that the institution of property in a woman comes about at the same time as institution of property in land. I mean, property, land doesn't immediately become property. It's something that evolves, and as far as we've learned over the last kind of 10 years that it evolves over several thousand years. It doesn't, land doesn't become property. Agriculture doesn't immediately turn into property societies. It's a gradual, slow process. So it's a dialectical process with the land and the women becoming property simultaneously.
What about the relationships in future socialist society? Do we dare hazard a guess at what they might look like, having had my pet theory about monogamy exploded by Richard's hunter gatherers? would we just say, oh well, you know, things will just carry on much as they are with monogamy, but with all the property and coercion power dynamics taken out? Or, you know, are we prepared to speculate about more, a kind of more mixed arrangement? What does anybody think?
Well, I don't think it would be the same pattern all across the world. You know, you'd have, you know, sort of emerging local cultures that, you know, choose to do things in their own way. And yeah, that would differ across geographical areas. So I don't, you know, there's not one template for a relationship norm in a socialist society. So yeah, that sort of throws it wide open, doesn't it? There's not just one thing that we're speculating. I don't know. Again, it would, I reckon, yeah, serial monogamy would maybe be more of a thing. I don't know, you know, communes, they're presumably have a place, you know, for people into a more sort of shared lifestyle in, you know, perhaps in terms of relationships too. So yeah, I think it would certainly differ. I don't think there's one answer to that.
Yeah, I'd just like to clarify very briefly, Paddy, although all immediate return hunter-gatherers that we know of are monogamous, it may be that there is something about the social relations of immediate return hunter-gatherer societies that dictates that. You know, so it doesn't necessarily imply that this is somehow natural, you know, or that it can't vary from society to society.
We'd all be free to choose, wouldn't we? We're all individuals. we'd all be free to choose. If I want to shack up with someone for the next 10 years or wherever long it lasted, I could do that. I think the main difference would be with families. I think children won't be seen as the property of their parents necessarily. I think perhaps children will be brought up communally, whether the parents want to live communally or not, whether they just want to have a monogamous relationship serially or whatever. I think families will change. I think you could possibly go back to extended families. You know, you could have your parents nearby, your grandparents nearby, because there's no financial obstacle for having family near you. I mean, a lot of family that are not, we've lost our extended family now and the support that it gives because of financial. Nobody can afford a house big enough to have your parents or your grandparent come and live with you. Now, some people may find this, you know, God forbid that you'd have your parent or your grandparent live with you. But however, this gives family support. It enables parents to be a little freer. Well, it enables parents to work, actually. So, you know, we won't need to have that same necessity. But I think it will change the family more than, say, individual relationships. I think the family will change a lot. And I think I just think it could be wonderful. It could be great, you know, when children. And also, if we have this communal thing about the way children are looked after, I think, you know, a lot of child abuse, a lot of stuff like that would be removed, because, you know, we've all got our eye on all the children, you know, because we're not suddenly going to become saints. You know, we're going to, like Janet says, we're going to take a lot of baggage from one society into the next, even though how gradual it might be, you know. And therefore, I think the more communal something is, where our families are concerned, I think the safer it is for all of us.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, actually, is that in capitalist society, you know, everything's behind closed doors, including relationships, including what goes on. And part of the process of socialising production in socialism will be, yeah, socialising our behaviour and socialising relationships, I would think, as well, and making these things much more communal. And so, as you say, I think things like child abuse would be, although I wouldn't say we could eradicate it, but I think it would be much more difficult for it to go on in a socialised community, definitely.
I'm thinking about one of the lesser known things about Lewis Henry Morgan, who Marx was very keen on, 19th century anthropologist. He wrote letters to thousands of people all over the world, had developed a means of distributing questionnaires and assembled them all. And what he actually discovered is that Western societies organization into family units where children have just one mother and one father is by far the exception. It's not the rule. It's really, really very peculiar from a historical and a global perspective for that sort of way of bringing up children to exist. In most traditional societies, as Carla was saying, there's children are brought up communally. And children choose who they want to spend their time with and live with. That's actually normal. And as she said, you know, I mean, these are outdoor face-to-face societies where everyone keeps an eye on everybody or on everybody else. And so, the abuse of children is very, you know, very, well, it's practically unknown. You know, I mean, in hunter-gatherer societies, all those that have ever been studied, the one value above everything else is children, is the value placed in children. They are the most important thing in the community.
That's really interesting, Richard. So You're saying the majority of cases around the world, according to Morgan's studies, the kind of so-called nuclear family was very unrepresentative.
Not just Morgan. I mean, it's been confirmed over and over and over again. And of course, less so these days as capitalism spreads. But in terms of pre-capitalist societies, yes. I mean, there were exceptions, like, for example, British society, going right back to the Middle Ages, has always had a nuclear family. I mean, it's not new in Britain to have nuclear families. But Britain then was, to some extent, exceptional, even in medieval times.
I also think that the extended family does not need one single residence in order to function. I mean, even in South Wales Valleys, we may not have the extended family under one roof. What we do have is the branches of the family still uniting and need to, especially when it comes for communal childcare. Myself and my partner, my wife Chris, we both muck in when it comes to our grandchildren. And any other thing I expect as well, you know, in Ordell Brown.
Well, I think this is, I don't know if anybody's heard of the grandmother hypothesis. I think this is something that seems to be, well, a lot of anthropologists and ethologists now believe this to be something deeply ingrained in human evolutionary history. It's always been a puzzle, for example, why women cease to be fertile at an age when they can go on living for another 20 and 30 years. And one of the reasons that most people now put forward by Sarah Hurdy, most anthropologists hold at the moment, is that because our traditional societies were matrilocal, women lived with their mothers and their mothers' families. The grandmother was there to help bring up the grandchildren, and so kind of the perception is that this is not just something that is cultural, but is actually something that has actually evolved within the human genome.
Old, and the older they get, the more chance of a defective child or birth is possible. So it's probably nature's way of not letting that happen.
The issue about that, Carla, is that the same is true of men, but men can have children very late in life, even though there is a higher chance of defective genomes. So the question is, why do women specifically cease to be fertile at this age? And I mean, there's lots of arguments about this, you know. I mean, I don't want to kind of take time up sort of getting technical, but yeah.
Okay, go on.
I was just going to say, you know, we've talked about love almost exclusively in terms of heterosexual family. I was just wondering if people had any kind of thoughts about non-heterosexual relationships.
I mentioned before, we're all free to choose whatever partner we want, whether it's same sex or not. I don't see a problem, and I don't see why any socialist or anyone that wants a socialist society would see a problem in that. Where's the problem? Affection and love is affection and love, no matter who you give it to.
Exactly what I was about to say, Carla.
Yeah.
And what about attachment?
Pardon? Could you say that again, please?
Yes. What about attachment? I mean, we do know that if children don't have sufficient attachment, they grow up with problems. both physically and mentally. Oh, if an individual doesn't have attachment to another individual, you know, I would think and assume also, you know, also the same thing applies. They're going to grow up with physical and mental problems.
No, I think you're relating that too much to the kind of society that we have now.
Yeah.
A socialist society will be very different from that. And it might be, you know, more community-wise, and that could be very small communities or larger communities, depending what people choose. But I see, actually, it could actually be quite a positive for an awful lot of children compared with what a lot of children live with now.
I'd have to disagree, you know, because there are studies that's been done that's illustrated attachment is essential to every human relationship, but more importantly, in the development of a child. If a child does not have that attachment relationship, all sorts of difficulties arise later in life.
I'm not really sure what do you mean by attachment?
So, to be nurtured, to be cared for.
Correct, Carla, that's it.
Okay.
And understood in security as well.
But that doesn't need to come from one individual. That could come from, for instance, in extended families, aunties, uncles. Sometimes children are more attached to an auntie or an uncle. You know, mothers are not necessarily... or fathers are not necessarily the best person for that child.
Well, again, at the risk of going on about this, I mean, there's lots of work done with hunter-gatherers. I mean, children are brought up communally. In fact, in one group that a friend of mine is an anthropologist, works as an ethnographer for, he says that children rarely touch the ground for the first 3 years of their lives in the group that he works with. They're simply passed around constantly from one person to another. And you know, it's like we tend to think of the family as consanguineous, you know, that they're related by blood. But again, this is not something that has been universal in society. In many of these societies, you know, your kin are people you choose. Not necessarily whether they are related to you by blood or not. If you can make anybody your kin, and the children are brought up either by your kin, they can have maybe anything up to 20 or 30 mums and dads. The words for these people that the children use are just mum and dad. They don't distinguish between their birth parents and their kin parents. And there's absolutely no evidence that the children are deprived in any way of attachment. I mean, they have multiple attachments. And you know, from everything I've been told by anthropologists who work in these type kind of communities, the children are supremely competent and well-adjusted and psychologically, you know, very sound.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Because, I mean, you can't expect to get everything from one person. So if you've got multiple attachments, you're likely, just by the law of averages, to be a more rounded individual, I would have thought.
Yeah, to go back to your meerkat, Paddy, they're an example of the... communal living. They may be monogamous or serial monogamous or whatever you want to call it, but the offspring are often raised communally. Nursing mothers don't just nurse their own; they nurse, whichever offspring needs feeding. I'm sure Richard can come in here and give us countless, communities in the past and probably still today, where the communal raising of children is normal and the children grow up to be well-adjusted members of the community.
There's if nobody else is going to come in on that, there's somebody called Gray, I forget his first name, He's particularly researching. He's a psychiatrist. He's researching child development, child raising, whatever the appropriate word for that is. And he's basing a lot of his research on the ethnography of hunter-gatherers and trying to come up with some way of identifying ways to bring up healthy, fit, mentally healthy children. And there's lots and lots of information out there now.
So I think to come back to a question that I asked earlier, does anybody think we should be saying and writing more about this subject, or do we take the view that, well, Brian seems to take that it's not really part of our case? Sorry if I've misunderstood you, Brian. It sounded like what you were saying. What do we think? Do we give this subject justice, or should we do and say more about it?
We should. I think it's really important for other people to see that, you know, that we are concerned not just with Marx and theory and that kind of politics, that we are concerned about human relationships, because it affects everybody and everybody can relate to that. Everybody relates to human relationships, whether they have them or don't have them, good ones, bad ones. We all relate to that, and I think we should talk about it more. I think we should explore ideas for the future. I think we should challenge, you know, we're challenging capitalism by challenging the nature of relationships today. And, you know, and we could compare relationships in capitalism and possible relationships post-capitalism. And I think that would be of interest to an awful lot of people.
Yeah, spot on again. I agree. Yeah, that's we should put more emphasis on the subject, either in, you know, talks or social standards articles. Yeah, because as Carla says, it's relevant to everyone.
Yeah, it wouldn't just be this topic as well. I feel people should feel free to write about whatever it is that's on their mind. It won't be a shallow something that they've got. They will obviously have given it a lot of thought. And no doubt there will be a perspective that they see from a socialist point of view. And whatever it is, who are we trying to relate to? We're trying to relate to all kinds of people in all kinds of different situations. And the wider the area is, I would have thought the more benefit it would be for us as far as spreading the word, just to be simple.
I just add into that, it's important to talk to people not just from a Western European perspective. We live in a rural community here in Turkey, and the relationships within family units is very different from how it is in the UK. And these people will often have a very good understanding of what they think socialism is. They know what the problem is. They live with it day in, day out. The majority of people in the countryside are subsistence farmers. They struggle. They know what the problem is. They know who the problem is. They know money is the problem. You don't have to talk to them about a moneyless society. They already, they can talk to us about it. But we have to relate to people from different cultures and different communities. And we really, what we're talking about, when we're talking about relationships, we're surely the pinnacle of relationships is empathy. It's empathy between a man and a woman. It's empathy between a man, a woman, and a child. It's empathy between you and your neighbor. It's empathy between you and a totally alien culture. We have to be open to all sorts of different possibilities, and not just be continually focused on the on the European Judeo-Christian tradition of capitalism, which we've largely imposed on the rest of the world anyway. But there are still elements of cultures around the world where they continue to function in a very different way.
That's brilliant, Alan. I think that's exactly right. And I'd like to say that, one of the things about studying anthropology is that it completely opens your eyes to your own presuppositions. I've learned so much about, so many things that I just take for granted about human relationships and the way in which, we generally just get on with one another, which once you actually start to go into it, you realize that human beings have organized themselves into societies of a vast range of shapes and structures, which are just kind of mind-boggling, many of which you would think could never ever work, but they work perfectly well. So it really opens your eyes to this idea that to be very, very wary about your own presumptions. And I talk to lots of socialists who will say about, sort of how they think socialism will actually look like. And I'm thinking, yeah, but that's just, even though you're not aware of it, you're actually projecting your own experiences and assumptions onto socialism. So I think we should really try and free our minds up as much as possible when we're talking about socialism and try and imagine, all kinds of possibilities and not get ourselves stuck in narrow ways of thinking that ultimately go back to our own society and our own presumptions. Because like Carla, I think we should talk about everything. I don't think there's anything that we shouldn't actually talk about as socialists, because everything that we are, that is human, is actually going to be affected by the structures of the world in which we live. And I think we just need to open our minds to that. It's essential. And the other thing is that there is nothing that we can talk about that isn't intimately connected with everything else we talk about. It's not that one thing exists in isolation from another. Everything is kind of like, and I hate to use the word, dialectically related to everything else.
Yeah, we want another Etherball to come on the scene. That's a certainty.
Well, I don't think anybody knows how to follow that. Those last few contributions really kind of summed up the state of the art, I think.
I think what they do, Paddy, is emphasize talk with the working class rather than talking at the working class. Which Alan was getting at. If you want to discover what relationships are all about, you need to talk with the people you're living with on the ground.
Yeah, I've heard you say that before, Brian, and I so agree with you. It's not easy if you're passionate about what you believe in, what you then it can be very difficult to allow the other person a word in edgeways and B, to really understand where they're coming from. We need to ask questions.
Yes, ask questions.
We need to ask questions of people and listen to what they have to say.
That's so right. We talk to one another from time to time and we say things like, oh God, I'm getting so frustrated with the working class because they can't get past the reformers. We get frustrated with the working class, but what we should be kind of recognizing is that if socialism is going to come into existence, it's the working class that is going to bring that about. So we have to adapt ourselves to the working class. Not sort of just get frustrating about them because they're not doing what we think that they should be doing. And although that kind of frustration is perfectly natural, as Alan has said, and it's very hard to get beyond it. But But I think they're just so important. I think the party is getting much better at listening. I mean, when I first joined in the 1970s, we weren't really listening at all. The boast was that, you know, we could beat all comers in debate. It was a purely adversarial attitude towards the working class and to other views within working class culture. I think we're getting a lot better at listening, and I think we still have to get a lot better still.
Yeah, I empathise with you there, Richard. I remember a few years back, Janet making her first contribution at summer school, and essentially, I can't remember the exact details, but it was basically about being prepared to talk with people who would not declare themselves to be socialists, but had a point of view. I don't care; it doesn't matter what it was, whether it was saving the trees or hugging dolphins or whatever else. It doesn't matter what it was. People have these. I think she was talking largely about single issues and how we need to relate to people. That really, their single issue will be a part of what we're talking about as socialists, because it will be addressed in socialism. And there was, I remember, I won't mention names because I can't remember, but there was one particular gentleman who was absolutely went on and on and on and on. I remember sitting there and thinking, I'm going to have to sort this bugger out. He's talking to Janet. It's not acceptable. And, I mean, I felt quite incensed at the time. But it is about, if we don't talk to other people, if we don't relate to what they relate to, if we cease to be dogmatic and talk and you know, and ask people, you know, what it is, what are they looking for? They're obviously looking for something different. And well, I don't know, I'm rambling on a bit here, but I'm trying to say we need to talk. As Brian says, we need to talk with people, not at them, to ask questions, maybe we'll get a little bit further on than we are now.
Well, I suppose I better ask if we feel we've done the subject. We've gone on a little bit longer than we would in an afternoon one, but you know, that's fine. There's no particular time limit. It's up to you.
Do you think it'd be worth trying to have another themed issue of the Standard on this? Of course, it would depend if you can get the articles in, you know, much like the one from the 70s that's been mentioned. Do you think that'd be worth looking into?
I think if we could get the writers, it really depends on whether people would do the produce the material.
I would approach her in that regard. I would definitely approach Kilgallen in regards to attachment theory, because he gives talks on it all around the country.
Well, we could always put out a request to members and writers and see if they would like to do it. I mean, maybe that's a more sort of proactive way to proceed. We could ask writers if they'd like to do it, and then. And then work on that basis.
Yeah, but very few know that Tim gives talks on attachment theory.
Well, we know now, thanks.
One subject, we need to kind of cover lots of relationship issues, don't we? So I think that's a great idea to try and get some stuff into the Standard. But as Paddy said, we need the writers. And, you know, from this little group here, I guess, you know, not that many members are that interested, to be quite honest.
Okay, well then, shall we consider the meeting wrapped up then?
Yeah, I think all points have been covered, don't they?
Yeah, fine by me.
Yeah, okay, all right, well,
okay.
Yeah, Well, thanks for an interesting discussion. And, yeah, I will talk to the editorial committee about this and, yeah, see what they say. I'm thinking of writing out to the writers anyway about on another matter. Richard, we're meant to be getting together about laws in hunter-gatherer societies and things, I think, aren't we, at some point?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we are.
Okay, all right, yeah. Well, yeah, so...
No, sorry, I've just been one thing and another.
No, I know.
But I'm still very keen to do that.
Okay, well, yeah, I think it's quite good with these FAQ things, if the things come out of them, you know, so I will try and see if we can get something out of this. That will be good. So, all right, well, I guess that's all for now. We do have another. I think it might have confused some people. That might maybe one reason why there's not too great an attendance tonight. I know a couple of people were interested but couldn't make it. And also, I think that some people are a bit confused about the move to an evening slot from the Tuesday afternoon. I know one person was expecting it to be on Tuesday afternoon still, despite notifications and things. But we've still got the Thursday afternoon slot tomorrow, where we'll be discussing another speculative subject: what's in the socialist high street. So hopefully some of you can get to that. That would be good.